This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Dalibor Rohatch, author of Governing the EU in an Age of Division, published by Edward Elgar next week on the 28th of November. Dr. Rohatch is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington and a research fellow at the Wilfried Martin Center for European Studies in Brussels. He was educated in economics at Charles University Prague, and then at Oxford, at George Mason University and King's College London. He's a prolific contributor to journals and news outlets, including the New York Post, and co-hosts the very good Eastern Front podcast. In his resume and his 2016 book, Towards an Imperfect Union, A Conservative Case for the EU, Dr. Rohatch comes at the European Union from an unusual direction. His argument is, quote, unabashedly pro-European, both in the sense that it wishes prosperity and peace for the European continent, and in the sense that it sees the EU and much of its institutional architecture as important components of its success, unquote. The book is a short and refreshingly realistic assessment of the EU's performance during a decade of unprecedented challenge and how it can adapt to the radically changed economic and geopolitical environment. Dalibor, welcome to the podcast.
Tim, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, as I said in the intro, I said you were coming at the EU from an unusual direction, but being conservative and pro-EU used to be very normal and still is in many European countries. But it's become unusual in the UK and the US. Now, I guess there are many reasons you wrote this book, but was one of them to try and reclaim a tradition that has been lost in the wake of Brexit and Trump?
I suppose that's a fair assessment. I mean, I grew up being influenced by classical liberal and conservative thinkers, by the Hayeks and Friedmans and Oakeshotts and Burkes of the world. Living in Eastern Europe, I always looked up to the figures of English and American, British and American conservative thought. And then I was somewhat sort of taken aback by the turn that conservatism in the English-speaking world has taken over the past decade, when this idea that conservatives ought to be primarily interested in conserving order and institutions that work got replaced by a sudden urge to break things, including things that, to me at least, seem to have been working all right, including the European Union, America's alliances, and so on and so forth. I presume that we might be past the peak of that urge on the conservative right, and I think it is important to invest in ideas and to make the case for why, much of the post-war international order, including the European project, are integral components of our prosperity and peace and many of the desirable features of our life in the Western world that we tend to take for granted.
Yeah, you wrote a piece, I think it was in 2016 for a magazine, but also, as I mentioned, the book you wrote in the same year, in which you admitted that you had been a Eurosceptic and had been converted. What was it that convinced you to go the other way?
Well, I still think that, and we can get into this further in the conversation, that the EU, as a very sort of peculiar, sui generis entity, has many flaws and problems, and there are many valid criticisms that can be addressed at the EU's institutional architecture. But by and large, looking at it from a longer historical perspective, it represents a dramatic improvement over what we've taken as the sort of baseline of European history. I mean, it's much better for the French and the Germans and the Dutch to argue about agricultural subsidies than to wage war against each other. I say that somewhat flippantly, but there has been, I mean, this notion which surprised me on the conservative right, particularly in the UK and in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, to sort of see the EU as something that's completely alien to, a conservative view of the world, to free market economics, and nothing could be, further from the truth. I mean, there is this long-standing tradition on the free market right going back into the 30s and 40s that focused in a very serious way on international institutional architecture that would enable markets in Europe to be open and integrated, and this generation of thinkers around Hayek and Repke and others were very forthcoming in their embrace of international federalism as a solution to what they saw was ailing Europe in the first half of the 20th century. At the same time, on the European Christian Democratic right, you had a long-standing tradition of particularly Catholic thinkers that were looking, for example, Switzerland as a model of federal governance for Europe. And it looks like really in 2015, in 2016, it's almost as if the British conservative tradition, and I'm not talking just about politicians who jumped on the Brexit train, but the sort of broader commentariat and intellectuals had somehow lost touch with those traditions, it seemed to me.
Coming to the book, you one of the things you discuss very early on is the history of this kind of liberal thinking about Europe, and you talk about the piece that Hayek wrote at the early on in the war that I guess many people don't know about. Could you expand on this this paper he wrote and his vision of a liberal federation that would constrain what he considered to be bad national policy making?
Well, 1930s were an interesting period when you had this cohort of thinkers, many of them coming from Vienna or from the German speaking world, who had to find refuge in Switzerland, in English speaking countries, running away from Nazism. At the time, unlike today, it's fair to say, when the academic world is dominated by US and UK universities, German-speaking world and Vienna were really places of real intellectual ferment and debates that were really at the cutting edge of, say, the economic profession or social sciences more generally. So many of these thinkers, especially on the sort of classical liberal right, were, for understandable reasons, horrified by what was happening in Europe, by the disintegration of the liberal international order that once existed, by the rise of Nazism in Germany and Soviet expansionism, and they were thinking about how a international liberal order could be restored. And so Hayek was in particular very critical of the 19th century classical liberal tradition for essentially neglecting this international component of how you can have free markets and limited constitutional government. He said that this was one of the biggest failures of that classical liberal project, that it didn't really engage seriously with the sort of preconditions that were needed for a liberal order to thrive. And already in 1938, you had the Walter Lippmann Colloquium in Paris that convened a bunch of classical liberal thinkers from the United States, from Europe, including from German-speaking countries, where these ideas were debated. And Hayek's article, which came out in 1939, was kind of a blueprint for how people could think about international federalism at the European level. It was followed by several other thinkers, some of whom actually rose to very prominent positions after the war. Luigi Einaudi, who was one of the post-war Italian presidents. You had people like Walter Eucken or Repke, who had real influence on politics and policymaking in Germany after the war, and they were all converging on this notion that then there need to be supranational institutions, not necessarily with the power to do all the things that nation states normally do, but with the power to constrain nation states from pursuing certain policies that would lead to this integration, this notion that we need to pool our economies in a way to make war unthinkable, I think was one of the intuitions that these thinkers did have, and they indeed provided a lot of input into the early architecture of the European project. Obviously, the EU, for understandable reasons, has always been a compromise of different ideas, of different interests. So I think it would be wrong to reduce it to a classical liberal project, but there is this component to it, and I think it's a rather important one, and it's one that I think classical liberals or libertarians and center-right conservatives of today should not give up on too easily.
Yeah, and of course, one of the key traditions of that group of people, I guess, particularly Röpke, was the Ordo Liberal tradition. And I sort of sum up the central theme of your book in a quote you have, where you say, "Quote: An important distinction exists between the politics of rules, at which the EU is quite adept, and the politics driven by events, which requires improvisation, risk taking, and alertness to opportunities." End quote. I mean, that seems obviously true in the last decade, but could you expand on that point about how the sort of liberal origins of the European Union, in a way, have become problematic over the last decade?
So it's not an idea that I originated. This was noted already by Luc van Middelaar, who is a Dutch philosopher who served as a speechwriter to Herman Van Rompuy when Van Rompuy served as the president of the European Council. And I think it's one of those points where this classical liberal or ordo-liberal tradition converged with some of the other drivers of European integration. I think there was this notion after the war on the center-left, when you read progressive center-left thinkers writing about European integration, that somehow this project is meant to overcome the old divisions and replace, you know, the nation state and the kind of conflicts that tended to emerge among nation states by qualitatively different political order, and the idea was that you know, in the course of becoming, I suppose, more civilized and progressive and better governed, we'll just have rules for everything. And I mean, the ordo liberals like rules, and also many people on the sort of central left are not averse to sort of rules and regulation. And you know, there is a grain of truth in the idea of the EU being, you know, an entity that primarily exercises its regulatory powers through the single market, through the rules of the monetary union, etc. And I think 2008, 2010. And the crises of the past decade came as a bit of a surprise to people who sort of thought that we can engineer away uncertainty and risk and events and conflict from European politics by just sort of setting up the right kinds of rules and letting, you know, history run its course as if on autopilot. It just, you know, didn't work that way. And suddenly European elites, politicians, people in European institutions had to sort of scramble and think about how to respond to these various crises. And, you know, we can talk about the specifics, but I would argue that it's been a, you know, mixed bag in a way. But it certainly was a sort of reminder that, you know, the world is just sort of too complex and unpredictable to be sort of reduced and governed by sort of simple rules-based system without any human input.
Yeah, actually, you make a very good point about that. I mean, we saw it in the sovereign debt crisis. We saw it again in the refugee crisis. That the dangers of adhering very strictly to rules and then collapsing at the last minute, very late in the day, you describe as the two-faced Machiavellian approach, cloaking power politics into a language of technocracy, and then essentially presenting these very radical solutions to a crisis as if people have no alternative to them. Could you expand on that point?
Yeah, I mean, the real risk that the EU has been running into lately, as I see it, is really, you know, being unable in a way to distinguish between technocracy and power politics, confusing the two and claiming that it was doing one thing when it was doing the other. And I think that has fed into a degree of cynicism that people on the far right, the sort of populists of the European continent has seized on. One example was, you know, the sort of canonically rules-driven response of the European Commission to the refugee crisis of 2015, when clearly Europe's borders were being overrun by an unprecedented number of asylum seekers and in some cases economic migrants coming to Europe, while member states were pursuing different asylum policies. And I mean, you know, the Commission's idea was to basically say, well, you know, we have to do burden sharing, and that means that we'll come up with fixed quotas based on, you know, some sort of technical assessment of different countries' capabilities, and that will be the end of it. Obviously, it was opposed by a number of Central Eastern European countries, yet it got passed at the Council by qualified majority, which hadn't been used before, at least not very often, to resolve conflicts of this kind of salience. And what happened was that that directive then got summarily ignored by countries like Poland and Slovakia and Hungary and others that voted against it. And you see this kind of, you know, hollowing out in some other areas as well, where, for example, in 2021, the Polish Constitutional Tribunal in Poland's ongoing standoff with European institutions over rule of law and organization of its judiciary basically ruled that, you know, this notion of supremacy of EU law over Polish law and supremacy of EU law over Polish constitutional system didn't exist. And therefore, you know, European Court of Justice had no mandate, no legitimacy, no purpose in sort of ruling over how the Poles should organize their judiciary to sort of meet European standards. And I mean, the danger is that the more you have these sort of unresolved conflicts that are not then addressed through political bargaining and mutual accommodation and so on and so forth, the more the EU becomes just a sort of hollow shell rather than an entity that can effectively set the rules that are then respected. You know, or to borrow another example, there was a similar standoff between the German Federal Constitutional Court and the European Central Bank and which has been a repeated one over the central bank's open market operations, the sort of bond buying programs that the ECB has launched. And there have been several decisions declaring it incompatible with German constitutional law. Because the case is dragged for so long, and because the ECB always had the opportunity to sort of rename the program, reframe the program, it just went on to the point when the ECB's portfolio has €5 trillion worth of bonds of national governments, which obviously is not received very well by a certain constituency in Germany.
Not hollowing out, you make it's very interesting insights you have where you sort of imply that the crisis has moved on from 2015, 2016, maybe even 2018, when there was still talk about the idea of a breakup of the EU. And you now see the greatest risk as a gradual hollowing out. And you point out that a hollowed out version of the EU with much of its bureaucratic apparatus could live on for decades. And we've seen this with many institutions, that they, once an institution is created and it has staff and it has a bureaucracy, it just stays there forever, basically, even though it has nothing to do. Is this what made you think of that as a potential scenario?
Well, I think the most important observation is that the case of Brexit made it rather unappealing for other countries to follow. And you already saw that in the 2017 presidential campaign in France, when Marine Le Pen initially floated the idea of leaving the euro, there was such a massive backlash that she immediately backtracked. And you see it, the sort of shift of the conversation both in France or in Germany in recent elections when figures on the populist Eurosceptic right had really toned down their rhetoric relative to where it was just a few years ago. Occasionally somebody like Viktor Orban would float this sort of idea of leaving the EU, but I mean, it really has become, just looking at this, the UK's sort of travails with leaving and thinking about what its relationship with the rest of the EU should be, just made it been a really, really sort of unappealing as a sort of model for others to follow, especially for countries that are so deeply integrated in economic terms and other terms. I mean, the UK, after all, is an island and has had all kinds of carve outs and opt outs and so on and so forth. For a sort of small, continental country, I think the sort of economic fallout would be much greater. So I don't think that's a real risk anymore. What is a risk is that because the EU fundamentally functions as a sort of voluntary association of countries, it's not a prison of nations, doesn't have much in terms of coercive powers. The worst it can do is to stop disbursement of EU money to your national budgets. So in a way, the compliance with the EU's rules and rulings of European Court of Justice is to some extent, to a large extent, voluntary. And that can easily create a situation in which the EU makes decisions and those decisions are ignored by countries or subgroups of countries. And yet the EU still lives on. I mean, we've seen many organizations, many international organizations that have outlived their original mandate, and they linger on, produce white papers, seem to have sort of pretenses at policymaking, but ultimately do not affect day-to-day life. And I do worry about that quite a bit, especially when I see countries, taking matters into their own hands when it comes to the four freedoms of the freedom of movement of people, of goods, capital and services. I mean, we've seen at numerous occasions during the pandemic and also in more recent months, countries just unilaterally reintroduce border controls, for example, in the Schengen area, when I'm not sure there was a compelling sort of national security or other case, or at least that case was not made explicitly by national government. So I think the more this goes on, the closer we might be to a situation in which the EU becomes a sort of less relevant and less sort of binding institution and more of a just, you know, debating society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're, I've had to read a lot of books on Eastern Europe and rule of law issues over the last few years. But to me, your chapter on what you call the light that didn't fail, which it was a dig at Ivan Krastev, I think, was probably the most clear-eyed one I've read of in terms of what the issues are, the combination of the rule of law issue, the misuse of EU fiscal transfers, and actually how they have encouraged rent-seeking and corruption. Could you take us briefly through that chapter and also onto your discussion of what you call the Great Conflation?
Sure. So yes, the title of the chapter is in a way a dig at Ivan Krastev, who, I mean, is a, you know, very interesting, prolific scholar and certainly someone worth reading. But in their recent book with Steve Holmes, or not, maybe not so recent, they paint what struck me as a very pessimistic picture of EU's enlargements and of the overall effect that these Eastern enlargements had, particularly on Eastern European, Central European societies, where they argue that they basically fed a certain politics of imitation in which Central and Eastern Europeans tried to become like Western Europe, and then they basically became disgusted by this whole enterprise, and that fed into this backlash led by figures like Jaroslaw Kaczyński in Poland and Viktor Orban in Hungary. And I just can't bring myself to look at this experience in such a negative, sort of pessimistic light. I mean, I came of age in what was in Slovakia at the time when it was about to join the European Union, and it was a period of, you know, great ferment, policy experimentation, excitement, which was not driven just by Slovaks acquiring the acquis communautaire and being sort of subjected to the civilizing forces of the EU. I think that's a view that just takes away so much of the agency that policymakers in these environments had. And I think the sort of more accurate view of things is to understand that many of the benefits that acceding accession to the EU generated in that part of the world was related to competition between Central and East European countries, that were sort of opening up at the same time to foreign capital and trying to be, you know, good, welcoming, attractive places to do business and invest. And that really drove, I mean, much of the prosperity that you see today in places like, if you go to Warsaw or Tallinn or Bratislava, the sort of amount of economic progress that had occurred is really extraordinary, notwithstanding, you know, many of the flaws and problems that these societies continue to have. So I see the effect of EU accession as, you know, overwhelmingly positive, but multifaceted. And one of the downsides was obviously was the inflow, large inflow of EU funds that followed after joining the club. You know, the EU is very hard to get into, maybe like Harvard University, but once you are an undergraduate student at Harvard, it's also very hard to you know, be, you know, fired from the club. You probably are going to graduate if you are already there. So the inflow of EU funds in a way reinforced some of these pre-existing patterns of political patronage and corruption that had existed, particularly in places like Hungary and to a lesser extent Poland. But I mean, you know, across the board, countries of Central and Eastern Europe do have a problem with corruption. And I think, you know, the worst examples are those when political corruption gets combined with entrenchment of incumbents who are in power. And I think, you know, Hungary in that sense is the sort of most egregious example. And I think only now the EU is sort of coming to terms with sort of understanding its own role in all this. And I think it's going to be a very interesting development to sort of follow and watch how and if an agreement is struck between the Commission and governments of Poland and Hungary over the disbursement of the recovery and resilience facility or Next Generation EU to these countries going forward. But in any way, that problem, I think it's sometimes conflated in particular in Brussels with the fact that Central and Eastern Europe is, you know, a different part of Europe than Western Europe. These are different societies with different historical experiences and therefore different attitudes towards things like immigration, towards things like gay rights, towards things like access to abortion, and there, I think, you know, where sort of Krastev might have a point is in sort of pointing out that there was this sort of general expectation in the West of progress as something inevitable and you know, inexorably marching forward, and that wasn't always the case across European societies. And when this problem of rule of law, of political corruption, of incumbent entrenchment gets conflated with you know, concerns about Central and Eastern European societies not being welcoming to immigrants, or you know, having a more sort of socially conservative view of things like abortion rights or gay rights, I think that's when, you know, the least responsible actors in those societies get empowered and are able to make you know, arguments against European integration that then just turn those countries into, you know, not exactly constructive actors, like in the case of particularly Hungary.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah. You make an extraordinary comparison, actually, between Europe today. I mean, you make it clear that it's not an exact comparison, but Europe today and the United States in the 19th century. So the sort of profound schism between two attitudes to social and cultural life. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so in 19th century America, obviously the United States were divided very deeply on fundamental questions of values, specifically on the question of slavery. And what happened with the expansion to the West was that new states or territories were created, particularly the Kansas Territory and Missouri, where these questions were not exactly resolved, And perhaps the expectation was that somehow they'll get resolved at the Western frontier. But what happened in 1840s, 1850s, in places like Missouri and Kansas, was that you basically had the sort of low scale civil war as a result of basically sort of debates over these highly divisive, polarizing issues being sort of outsourced to the Western periphery. And again, like it's a very imperfect comparison, but 15, 20 years ago, these questions of gay rights and access to abortion, etc., were polarizing in Western Europe, at least in some Western European societies, and perhaps continue to be so to this day to some extent. And in a way, with the accession of Eastern European countries, Central European countries, those countries suddenly had to face those debates, not by their own choosing, but just by virtue of joining the same club, not unlike that Western periphery of the United States. And so perhaps it's not entirely surprising that it fed, you know, the sort of most irresponsible and most polarizing form of politics in those countries as well. So I mean, my only hope is that these conflicts do get resolved eventually, without the need for, you know, what actually resolved those conflicts in the United States in the 1860s. I mean, you know, I certainly don't expect that to happen. I don't fear that will happen, but those conflicts that exist in Europe are still severe enough to bring about dysfunction and just sort of lack of coherence to European decision making.
Well, and we've covered the critique part of the book. The book has a number of proposals for positive change, and they're probably centered around this idea of polycentrism. Could you expand on what that means and what it means in the context of the European Union?
Sure. So I suppose that there's a number of different sort of premises that go into my sort of practical conclusion side of things. One is the observation that the EU has gotten significantly more diverse with its enlargements to the east, both economically, both in terms of, you know, sort of the values set up and view of things, such as immigration, gay marriage, etc., in terms of the quality of governance in different countries. And so the kinds of deep political cooperation that could have been thinkable among the founding members of the EU might not be possible at EU 27. And the other premise is that the EU, in my view, should be understood primarily as a platform for managing disagreement and conflict, that these things are not going to go away. They're not going to be sort of overcome through inexorable march of history towards ever brighter future, but are part of the European condition, that this is a very diverse, heterogeneous, pluralistic continent, and it's likely to stay that way. With those sort of starting points, my wish is in a way to change political culture, both in Brussels and in national capitals, in a way that reduces the stakes of these existing conflicts. And the way to do it, I think, is to think about the EU not as of a monolith which is threatened every time there is a crisis or a disagreement in this or that area of policymaking, but as of a essentially juxtaposition of different integration projects that can run in parallel, that can encompass a different, slightly different sort of imperfectly overlapping coalitions of participants, and that would cooperate on producing public goods that they agree are necessary to produce. I mean, it sounds like, you know, I'm advocating a sort of this complete disaggregation of the EU into different sort of things, but actually I think some sort of foundational rules are necessary. In my ideal world, those foundational rules would be much thinner than the existing acquis communautaire. I think the four freedoms are are again the sort of beating heart of the European project. But I'm, you know, just comfortable accepting the EU as it exists in terms of its institutional setup. Right? I don't think a change of treaties is particularly likely or even desirable, given how it would likely go. Yeah. And therefore, I would like countries that want to cooperate more to do so without really having to sort of work their way through the assumption and the rigors of doing everything through the community method at the level of, you know, EU 27, and rather by relying through the institution that already exists within the Lisbon Treaty of enhanced cooperation that enables countries that want to do more to do more, while, you know, without dragging along countries that are perhaps more skeptical of the merits of cooperating. I think that would sort of reduce the stakes of disagreements that exist in the EU, would allow progress to take place in areas where it ought to take place. It would provide an alternative to, you know, people trying the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, namely making the case for, you know, getting rid of unanimity and replacing it by qualified majority vote. And it would also reduce, I think, the sort of stature that the sort of not exactly constructive autocrats such as Viktor Orban enjoy in today's EU by being able to block initiatives and just being generally unhelpful.
Are you surprised at how infrequently enhanced cooperation has been used? I mean, the one I followed for a long time was the financial transactions tax, and it went to enhanced cooperation with a bunch, I think 9 countries who were claimed that were very keen to do it, and they still got nowhere, I think, after 10, maybe even 12 years. Do you think there's countries have essentially hidden behind unanimity on a lot of issues that they didn't actually really want to resolve?
I think that's true in some areas, particularly in foreign policy, where for a long time, I think there was this sort of strange symbiotic relationship between Hungary and Germany, when, you know, sort of Hungarians would be the ones vetoing things formally, but they were able to do it because they knew that there wouldn't be much of a pushback coming from Berlin. But I'm not actually sort of convinced that enhanced cooperation has been so infrequent and sort of odd as you suggest. I mean, there were some other examples, European patent, divorce law, but also things like PESCO and defense cooperation are essentially intergovernmental, in the sense that, yes, they might be sort of relying not on Article 20 of the Lisbon Treaty, but on some other legal setup. But in their de facto operation, they involve different coalitions of member states, you know, doing things jointly without involving everybody, without sort of requiring everybody to sort of be involved in the same things. Even perhaps the most important part of the response to the Eurozone crisis, the European Stability Mechanism, was created outside of the scope of European treaties by a sort of subset of EU member states. And to me, that really should be the way forward by default, especially in areas where we sort of know that relying on the community method gets us nowhere because of individual countries' vetoes. I mean, those vetoes, that veto power exists for a reason, right? I mean, countries like Poland are not going to sign up for a foreign policy that relies on qualified majority rule, particularly given their experience with Russia and given the fact that the big players in Western Europe were consistently wrong from the perspective of Warsaw on the subject. So you know, to tell them, as Chancellor Scholz suggested earlier this fall in Prague, that, you know, we have to get rid of unanimity, like it's just not going to fly in these Central and Eastern European capitals.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons they like saying it, because it sounds good, but they know it won't happen. But on that, I mean, talking about the Prague summit, you wrote a piece for Politico, I think last month, where you talked about your hopes and ambitions for the European political community as a crucial bridge or even an outer circle to encompass Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, the Western Balkans, but even potentially the UK and Switzerland. What are the realistic ways you think this could be made to work and interact with the European Union?
So I do think there is a need to for member countries of the EU to think carefully about their relationship with countries that are outside of the EU, and that's in part the UK, which has played, you know, for all the, you know, domestic omnishambles we've seen over the past year, the UK has played a massively helpful and constructive role in addressing Russia's aggression against Ukraine, in helping the Ukrainians. I mean, the UK is one of the, you know, few remaining real military powers in Europe. So the idea that we have to keep the UK close, I think, should be a no-brainer for anybody who takes Europe's security seriously. And I've been heartened to see the former Prime Minister go to Prague and to have the UK sign up for a closer relationship with PESCO. And I would like to see the UK to, you know, think about, you know, ways it can do more things together with the Europeans. I mean, I wouldn't be averse to, you know, building over time a Swiss-like relationship, you know, tying UK markets in particular sectors to the single European market. I know it's a very sort of sensitive topic in the British debate right now, but ultimately, that strikes me as a way of building a sort of sustainable future in which the UK is just not part of those aspects of the European project that have always rubbed the British the wrong way, and is cooperating in areas where it makes sense for both sides. And something similar, I think, is true of the EU's enlargement, of EU's sort of engagement with its southeastern and eastern neighborhood. For a while now, further enlargements to the east have seemed unthinkable because of where the majority opinion in places like France and Germany was. And I think there was this sort of fatigue with European institutions sort of going through the motions of negotiating with, say, Serbia and Eastern Partnership countries, but everybody sort of knowing that this was not going to go anywhere, and that I think fed into the cynicism that also exists today, in particularly in the Western Balkans towards the EU. And so I was heartened actually to hear the Commission President Ursula von der Leyen say in her State of the Union speech in September that Ukraine going forward should be brought into the single market as soon as possible, implying that this could happen without Ukraine necessarily joining the EU at the same time, because obviously for Ukraine to join the EU, I mean, that's like, you know, it's going to be a long process, and it's going to be difficult, and it's going to run into lots of obstacles, but there is a certain sense of urgency around just, you know, bringing as many of the benefits of the European project to the Ukrainians as quickly as practicable. So I think sort of, you know, separating different attributes and sort of dimensions of European integration and treating them on their own merits, as opposed to bundling them into the sort of existential sort of issue around accession negotiations would be a helpful way to revive the enlargement agenda, particularly in places like Ukraine, Georgia, Western Balkans, and hopefully at a later stage, you know, towards Belarus and others who would choose to sort of become closer with the EU.
Yeah. Well, As always, to close the interview, I've asked my guests to recommend two books, one in their field and one personal choice. Dalibor, what have you chosen?
Well, I have two books. I have to say they're both non-fiction books that deal with...
That's allowed.
Some of the matters we've discussed already. So one very thick volume I'm halfway through, which is absolutely fascinating, is by Paul Tucker. It's called Global Discord, Values and Power in a Fractured World Order. And it deals with this challenge of facing a world that seems to be deglobalizing and that entails conflicts of values between large global powers, and tries to provide a way forward for building still a sort of rules based order within those constraints. And the other book I would like to recommend, which has just come out, is by an Israeli academic, Azar Gad. It's called Ideological Fixation, From the Stone Age to Today's Culture Wars. And it addresses exactly that, sort of, the sort of human proclivity for adopting, simplifying ideological sets of lenses, and how that fuels conflicts over values, and how that's, a permanent feature of the human condition, so to speak.
Great. Well, they're both new ones on the list, so thank you. Today, I've been talking to Dalibor Rohatch about his Governing the EU in an Age of Division. Dalibor, thanks very much for coming on.
Tim, thank you so much for having me.